Hey there, I'm Kendra Adachi, and my show, The Lazy Genius Podcast, helps you be a genius about the things that matter and lazy about the things that don't, and you get to decide what matters. I'm not here to tell you what to do. I'm here to give you a new way to see. Episodes of The Lazy Genius Podcast are full of compassionate time management tips and permission slips to do what makes sense for you. New episodes drop every Monday. Follow and listen to The Lazy Genius Podcast on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
9:09 now on this Monday morning, and one good thing about it being a kind of slow time of year is we get to have some fun and talk about some topics that we normally would not. We're going to talk about colloquialisms specifically as they relate to beverages, okay? And our guest is Valerie Friedland. Am I pronouncing it right, Professor?
Pretty close, Friedland, but that's close enough.
Friedland. Well, that's okay. You know, I'm going to throw an E in there. I'm going to buy you an E, like Wheel of Fortune. I'll
everybody,
buy an E.
Everybody seems to like to give me an E, but that's all right. I like vowel, so I'm good with it.
So, but it's pronounced Friedland, right?
Yep, Friedland.
Yeah, but there's no E in it. That's why I'm going to buy you an E. Go ahead, take it. Who am I to change your cert? I'm just kidding. Now I'm going cert names and all that stuff. Anyway, Valerie is a professor of linguistics and author of, like, literally, dude, arguing for the good in bad English. How you doing?
I'm good. How about yourself?
I'm okay. Joining us from Reno, Nevada. Is Reno the biggest little city in the world? Did I get that right or not?
I think you did, yes. It's definitely a big little city. Almost
outgoing like it?
It's littleness. It's starting to become a big city. I do. I like it very much. We're right in the Tahoe Mountains. It's quite pretty.
Yeah, it's can get hot, too. I saw it was 68 degrees. We're going up to 100 today.
Yes, today we've actually had really mild temperatures all through June in the 80s, and all of a sudden we're in the hundreds, and it's kind of painful.
Well, we're going to have to do something about that. Let's talk about, first of all, linguistics. How do you go from being 9-year-old Valerie to being a professor of linguistics, an author of, like, literally, dude, arguing for the good and bad English? Tell me your story. I want to hear it.
Yes. Well, when most people, you know, are thinking I want to be a doctor or a lawyer, 9-year-old Valerie was not thinking I want to be a linguist. I had no idea that even existed, but I went to Georgetown University for my undergraduate degree, and I had to take a couple of linguistic classes as part of my major. I was a language major, and so I took this class, and I think it was just called social linguistics, which is actually the type of linguist I am. But we did this section on language and gender and how language changes depending on, you know, whether you're male or female. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of rocked my world, probably because I was looking for ways to accuse my boyfriend of things at that time. And this gave me perfect ammunition for everything I thought he was doing and the way he spoke and what, or the way he never took responsibility for things. So I embraced it and I took a bunch more classes. And that's when I decided this sounded like a great career. But it was really one of those things I just kind of fell into it after I took a class in that, and I ended up getting a PhD, and that's it. That's the story.
Did you wind up marrying this fellow or not?
Nope, I didn't. I married one whose language I approved of.
There you go. Let's talk about linguistics for people that don't know. What is that?
It's basically the scientific study of language. So most people think of linguists as people that speak a lot of languages, but the type of linguist I am is called a theoretical linguist, and so I'm more interested in understanding the underlying structure of languages. So what makes languages form the way they do? What makes languages change over time? What does the brain look like in terms of how it processes language? And my particular specialty, which is social linguistics, is how do facets of our social identity interact with parts of our language? So, for example, the rise of like use, you know, how does that happen? Why does it happen? And what does it mean?
So kind of like Henry Higgins in a way?
Exactly. Actually, that's pretty accurate assessment. I'm very much like Henry Higgins, minus the
Henry Higgins.
Yep, Henry Higgins. Yep, minus the judgment. I look at language evolution as something natural and fascinating and driven by social forces along with natural linguistic tendencies. So I'm less interested in changing people's speech as understanding it.
So first of all, we'll get to the soda pop thing in a second, but here in New Orleans, I don't know if it's like this in every other city or not, because the only other place I've lived in my life was Las Vegas for about a year. But it's and there at that time they were printing 2 phone books a year because people were moving in and out so much. So I don't know that there would be a dialect that you could trace to one place or the other. But I do know here in New Orleans, man, I could probably point out 7 or 8 different dialects, and we're not that big of a city just throughout the city, within the city itself, and the urban area and the suburban area. How does that develop, Professor? Because you would think if you're all in one, you know, 500 square mile radius, you'd be speaking the same language, but absolutely not.
Absolutely not. I mean, if you look at Britain, which has even more diversity of dialects in the very, very concentrated space. I mean, my next book, which comes out in about a year, is all about the evolution of dialects. And it's actually quite fascinating and complex. But the long and short of it is it's partially by geographic separation that we get dialects emerging, but also very, very much about social separation. So you can be in the same place, but not be in the same social space. And it's distance between us, whether that's physical distance or social distance, that ends up making these inherent tendencies that we have in language. So the ways our brains and mouths work actually interact with social triggers. So things like, I'm not talking to you because I don't like you, or I'm not talking to you because we're socially distant, or we don't talk a lot because we're in different class structures and we don't interact a lot, whatever type of distance it is, makes those tendencies turn a little different in one group versus another. So it's sort of a natural evolutionary process that language does anyway. Language always changes. It's part of the structure of language to do that because of the way our brains and mouths work. But then when I'm in one group that doesn't talk to another group, those little tiny subtle changes change differently because we're not talking to each other so that we don't get hit by the same tendencies. We don't start to speak like each other. And then over time, those small differences start to become larger differences. And that's how we went from having one language, you know, 50,000 years ago to having 7,000 languages today, which none of which were that original language. And so basically, you get different languages because first evolved different dialects.
I'd like to invite the audience in here at 504-260-1870. That's the O'Connor Jeweler Talk and Text Line. Please don't text and drive, but text your questions in and text this in for me if you could. I'm trying to identify as many different accents as I can here in the area. I know they got Chalmette, they got Uptown, they got West Bank, they got Ninth Ward, they got all different kind of accents, Gentilly. And it's we're not that big of a city, Professor, but for example, N-E-W-O-R-L-E-A-N-S. Pronounce that for me.
Wait, N-E-W...
O-R-L-E-A-N-S.
Oh, New Orleans.
Okay. Here, you could hear it as New Orleans. If people are uptown, you could hear it as New Orleans, as that's how I say it because I grew up here. You could hear people that, you know, try to be all fancy and everything if they're local like you are saying New Orleans. You can hear New Orleans. How can there be that much of a difference in one area with the way people say the name of the city? And one thing that I will say is absolutely inaccurate is Nolans. Nobody ever says Nolans. So, Professor, please do us all a favor and never say that.
I will never say that. Notice I didn't say that. Well, everybody who's not from New Orleans would say Narlands, right? Maines are really a fascinating area. And I actually have to say I was very impressed you pronounced Nevada correctly. And that then when you said you lived
because
in
I live
Vegas,
there.
I explained it.
Because I lived there,
yeah, especially from your part of the world right now, would not know how to pronounce it. It would say Nevada. That actually hurts for me to even say.
Yep.
So place names are actually often places where we have different pronunciations. And I don't study New Orleans speech, so I don't know that much about it. I've read a paper on something called the Yacht dialect. Y-A-T. That's very Yacht. And I know that there are a great diversity. In that paper, they talk about the great diversity of dialects there. And a lot of dialects spawn from settlement history differences, the origins of them. And New Orleans had quite a fascinating settlement history that not only involved settlers from different parts of England, which really is what established most of the dialects down the sort of northeastern corridor, But in New Orleans, you also had a lot of layers of different language settlement. And so, and whenever you start with seeds of difference, those seeds of difference generally spawn more and more dialects and areas that are more uniform in their development. So, you know, I don't know that much about New Orleans itself in terms of its language, because there are people that study that and I'm not one of them. But when you get a lot of diversity like that, what that tells you is there has been a lot of origin diversity in terms of where people were from, but also social diversity in terms of the types of settlement patterns that were established in that city. So when you have places that had sort of certain speakers settle together and maybe not talk to the ones as often, or maybe not like the ones as often that settled elsewhere, you always end up with divergence over time. And when you throw into that picture language diversity, which New Orleans certainly has, and ethnic diversity, you end up with great linguistic diversity. So the more layers you put on, the more dialect layers you get off. Does that make sense?
It does. And just so you know, Nolens is the equivalent of Nevada.
Mm-hmm. That I will never say it. I promise you that. To everybody there, I will never say that, because Nevada is like nails on a chalkboard.
Yeah, I know. I live there. That's the only reason I know. And I constantly correct people when they say Nevada. It's like, well, no, not really. The other thing I've heard is that people that live in San Francisco are not terribly fond of the phrase Frisco.
That's right. That's right. I've actually never heard someone here, because we're very close to San Francisco. Mm-hmm. We're only about 3.5 hours away. I've never heard anybody here refer to it as Frisco. That is absolutely right. I mean, it's, you know, a lot of different states have their names. So here in Nevada, we also have some places like Verde, which is actually spelled Verde and probably actually named after Verde, but it's pronounced Verde, and people here will know you're an outsider if you don't pronounce it that way. So these are called linguistic shibboleths, which are these little cues that people have to outsiderness. And that's the beauty of language, and that's the beauty of dialects, is what they actually signal to us is who's in our tribe and who's not. I mean, that's historically how they...
Hey there, I'm Kendra Adachi, and my show, The Lazy Genius Podcast, helps you be a genius about the things that matter and lazy about the things that don't, and you get to decide what matters. I'm not here to tell you what to do. I'm here to give you a new way to see. Episodes of the Lazy Genius Podcast are full of compassionate time management tips and permission slips to do what makes sense for you. New episodes drop every Monday. Follow and listen to the Lazy Genius Podcast on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
They started to emerge over time, but really what they signal now is who gets us and who doesn't, who's local and who's not, who's in our group and who's outside of it. And that's really why you get this diversity that withstands this immense communicative sort of hodgepodge we've become, where we talk to each other a lot more than we did 100 years ago.
So many questions. We'll pick it up here. We come back talking to Valerie Friedland, professor of linguistics, author of Life, Like Literally Dude, Arguing for the Good and Bad English. She is a professor of linguistics at the University of Nevada, Reno. Any questions or comments? 504-260-1870. We'll talk about soft drinks when we come back. Let me read this text real quick before we go to break I just closed the window, actually, so I'll read it when we come back. But it's about the whole soft drink, soda pop, whatever you call it, or the generic Coke, and how do some products or some items become generic. I still call them Scott towels, although people call me on that constantly. 922, talking linguistics and pronunciations and more. We'd love for you to get involved. 504-260-1870. Tommy Tucker back in a flash. WWL. We're talking to Valerie Friedland, professor of linguistics and the author of Like Literally Dude, Arguing for the Good and Bad English. Somebody texted in and said they just ordered the book. Before we get to the great soft drink debate, professor, tell me about the book.
Like Literally Dude is about all those vocal tics that people love to complain to me about. And mm-hmm. Every time I give a talk or lecture in my classes or in public, people would always come up with the same sort of top 10 hits of things they hate, which is things like using literally, non-literally, saying like all the time, that vocal fry that, you know, we often hear from the Kardashians and a lot of young women. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, well, why not write a book about these, explaining their history, their evolution, and their use, so that I don't have to keep answering the same question. So it turned out to be a really, really fun book about a lot of things that I think people will be really surprised at how these linguistic features evolved in a very natural way to take care of problems we didn't even know we had. And so that's really the heart of that book.
It's like I was literally walking 3 feet off the ground. No, you really weren't, because you would have to have been somewhere where gravity didn't exist for that to happen. Somebody texted an Air Force brat here. I used to live in Germany and then North Dakota before here in Louisiana. In Europe, we called it soda. North Dakota, it was pop. At a restaurant, we would then be asked what kind. Down here, 30 to 25 years ago, we would say, I'd like a Coke, then be asked what kind. Being asked what kind of Coke you want, but I asked for and got a Mountain Dew. To be honest, I was confused. Let's talk about the great, I don't even know what the generic term would be, Professor. Will we call it a carbonated beverage? Tell me about all of this, because I find this fascinating.
It actually really is. It seems like a silly topic, but it has a huge history behind it.
But let me say this, too. Let me interrupt for 1 second. That's what I love about this time of year, because there's not a lot going on, and it gives us a chance to explore some topics that are fun, which is what we're doing for this hour. So go ahead, please.
Okay. Well, yeah. So I grew up in the South. I'm from Memphis, actually, originally. Mm-hmm. And when I was growing up, and you sort of said it was 30 years ago, so I'm going to pretend that you didn't say that. And so when I was young, just a few years ago, I grew up saying generic Coke mm-hmm. for whatever drink people wanted. So when I moved out of the South, people thought that was very odd, that when I would say I'd like a Coke, I actually meant a Sprite. But this is something that has long sizzled, or bubbled, I should say, in the American psyche. And the argument about what to call a soft drink, which is kind of the more generic term I think that people use today, but carbonated beverage would also be the very formal way to say it, mm-hmm. has actually been effervescing for about 100 years. So it's been around a long time. Now, the particular terms pop and soda have actually been around almost 200 years, but their use for what we would today refer to as a soft drink is really a 20th century, an early 20th century issue.
Now, what I find interesting is I'm looking at a map here of usage of soda, pop, Coke, or soft drink, and I don't see a lot of soft drink on this map. I don't know what the source is that Jordan Fiegel sent to me, but it seems like soda popular in the West and especially in the Northeast, pop in the maybe Midwest, and then down south it's Coke. Would that be the proximity and brand awareness of Coke in Atlanta?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Not only do you know how to say Nevada, you also know the heart of the Coke question. Coke was actually invented in 1886 by a pharmacist by the name of John Pemberton at Jacob's Pharmacy in Atlanta. A lot of Coke history there. It was a medicinal syrup. The basic sort of formula for Coke was a medicinal syrup made out of coca leaves and cola nuts, which actually gave it a trace amount of caffeine and cocaine at the time. Mm-hmm. And it was marketed as a medicinal syrup, and it somehow got mixed in with carbonated water. How exactly, some people say it was an accident, but it was actually a pretty common practice for pharmacists to mix syrup with carbonated water at the time. And that became the first Coke was served at that pharmacy. And so it's a ubiquity in Atlanta and in the South more generally, once it started getting distributed in the early 1900s particularly, is exactly why Coke became a generic name for it in the South. And it actually has grown. So in the 1940s and 50s, you would hear generic Coke for the first time, really, and not being used for a brand name, but for a generic purpose. And every decade since, there was a linguist named Thomas Murray that did a study in the, I think, late 1990s, where he found that every decade since the 1940s, when we first see that word in the core Midland southern states like Kentucky, Tennessee, and Arkansas, and West Virginia, you see an expansion of the generic Coke out to the rest of the South, to Texas, and even by the 1990s outside the South, probably from Southern kind of migration elsewhere. But it really has expanded over the last 70 years where you get generic Coke, not just in the South, but you can hear it everywhere.
What about cold drinks? Somebody, I'm getting a lot of texts here about cold drink, and I always ask when I'm somewhere and if I get a soft drink, that's what I call it, I think I call it. I don't know. You got me thinking about this now, knowing you were coming on. I asked the young lady yesterday, because I always say, can I get you a soft drink? Because, you know, it's like I'm friendly. I like to do that when I'm checking out. And she said, no, thank you. But then it gets even more confused because now, in addition to having soft drinks, they have bottled waters, they have fruited waters, they have this, they have that, they have the other thing. Where did cold drink come from? Maybe that just covers it all. Maybe if I say cold drink, if I'm offering to buy somebody something, that covers soft drinks, covers caffeinated beverages, whatever, Monster Energy, whatever happens to be in there, right?
Right. Well, there are parts of the country where cold drink mainly refers to what some of the people might call pop or soda. And soft drink is, now the fascinating history about soft drink is it's actually a term that was not just to refer to what we would call soda today. Originally, a soft drink emerged in the early 1800s to refer to drinks without alcohol, because at the time, carbonated drinks were very hard to produce. So non-alcoholic carbonation was only invented, created naturally in the mid to late 1700s by a man named Joseph Priestley, who happened to live next door to a brewery and noticed that the grain fermentation process produced a gas that made beer bubble. And so people had been trying to carbonate water for centuries, as far back as Hippocrates. Physicians used to prescribe the drinking of naturally effervescent mineral water or the bathing in it, but not everybody lived near a bubbly stream, right? So people were trying to create artificially carbonated water for centuries, but it actually takes a lot of chemistry to do so. And it wasn't until, I think it was 1767, that Priestley was able to figure out, using grain hops, a way to put some bubbles in water artificially, and that's only because he happened to drink a lot of beer. So, you know, lucky for him, it was a beer drinker. But it was Jacob Schweppe, actually, that took that process, which people reported as tasting and smelling bad, the one that Priestley invented, and he actually was able to make it taste better and sort of upscale production so that he could actually bottle it and distribute it. And that was when it became sort of known as a non-alcoholic.
Hey there, I'm Kendra Adachi, and my show, The Lazy Genius Podcast, helps you be a genius about the things that matter and lazy about the things that don't. And you get to decide what matters. I'm not here to tell you what to do. I'm here to give you a new way to see. Episodes of The Lazy Genius Podcast are full of compassionate time management tips and permission slips to do what makes sense for you. New episodes drop every Monday. Follow and listen to The Lazy Genius Podcast on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Alcoholic option, because the other fermented kind of bubbly drinks were all alcoholic. So you had a hard drink, which we still call alcoholic drinks today hard. But what we don't do is call all non-alcoholic drinks soft anymore. That's only for soft drinks. But originally the term soft drink was for all non-alcoholic drinks, which then cold drinks kind of took the place of. But there are places in the U.S. That sometimes just call it a cold drink where that's popular. But there's also places where it's called tonic, right? New England, tonic is a term that's sometimes used for soda. In parts of North and South Carolina, although it's dying out, the word dope was actually used to refer to specifically Coca-Cola as a soft drink. So there are a variety of these sort of smaller used terms, but the predominant three are really Coke, soda, and pop. The majority of people use one of those.
Have you ever heard of a sandwich being dressed?
Would that mean that you put some, like, vinaigrette on it? Or
lettuce, tomato, mayonnaise? Lettuce, tomato, mayonnaise, et cetera. And I guess that's a New Orleans thing. I don't know. I was just wondering if you'd, in your research, found that in any other area. Because when I did move to Nevada, I got a sandwich, and I asked them, does that come dressed or not? And they looked at me as though I were from another planet. We'll take a break. Pick it up here when we come back. I want to talk about some of the changes, regional dialects, because here, for whatever reason, and look, I can go to New Orleans whenever I want and just stop pronouncing the R's and talk like we used to, you know, like going to the car and get a beer and those kind of things. And what you're going to do, you're going over there or not. And so we have this dichotomy where, you know, you can either speak like we do here, or you can get all fancy and everything when you go to see people and start pronouncing your R's and everything else. But yet those dropped R's, that can go to like Boston. I've had people already question when I slipped into my native New Orleans accent if I was from New York or Boston or those kind of areas. So we'll talk about that and more. Interesting hour we're spending with Valerie Friedland, professor of linguistics, author of Like Literally Dude, Arguing for the Good and Bad English, which I guess you can get at all the usual outlets. Traffic now, WWL. 14 till 10, Tommy Tucker, WWL, having an interesting hour with Valerie Friedland, a professor of linguistics at the University of Nevada, Reno. And the book is Like Literally Dude, Arguing for the Good and Bad English. And what's the next book, Professor?
The next book, which is coming out in April, is Why We Talk Funny, The Real Story of Accent, which traces the sort of science, history, and psychology behind accents that have developed over the centuries.
I will miss the smarty pants, Jordan Fiegel, our producer. First of all, the word, I don't know if you want to write it down, Professor, but it's C-A-L-L-I-O-P-E. How do you pronounce it?
C-A-L-L-I-O-P-E?
Yeah.
Calliope?
Well, it's a calliope, actually.
I'm not sure.
Calliope? Like the mute. But it's interesting, the reason I said that, I don't mean to catch you flat-footed, but he refuses to say calliope, which is how we pronounce it here, because he thinks it's wrong. But he talked about code switching, which is, I think, what I was asking you about before, because I, you know, I'm thinking about getting a new car. I don't know what kind of car I'm going to get yet, but when I do, I'll probably ask about a car. Why is it that somehow we drop R's in one area or the other? Sometimes people think I'm from New York, and I know it's happened to other New Orleanians as well. What's going on there? Why do we, and then it gets even more confusing, because sometimes I'll get caught up on the air between in no man's land where I say idea instead of idea. Which,
oh, yeah, it's the intrusive R.
Yeah.
Well, R is fascinating. In fact, I have a whole chapter in my next book devoted to it, because it's probably one of the most fascinating accent features that tells us a lot more about our history than we mm-hmm. realize. So the reason that we find it in various pockets in the United States is actually really due to its evolutionary history as a late 19th century development in British English. So the mm-hmm. colonies, when the colonies were settled, the majority of them in the 1600s, 1700s, there were R's everywhere. So in British speech, people did not drop R's yet either. And but there is an inherent tendency to R, something called weakening, where R's get less strong or hard as people, you know, evolve, as our mouths get to do what they want to do. And which is why, you know, you get that Scottish R that's a really hard kind of brogue R, and the Irish too. That's gotten a lot weaker in English, because that was more what Old English's R's probably sounded like. But over time, R's weaken. And so this very low-level tendency in British speech that was present in the 1600s and 1700s, but not yet very fully realized. So you'd hear it here and there. So you'd see something like the word worst would be pronounced wust, or first, you'd find it written as fust in that time, in that century. But it wasn't until the late 1800s you really see R dropping happening in British speech. So the predominant pattern in the United States was that people had their R's, because that's the time that most colonists had come over, is before it was lost in British speech. But port cities are ones with high levels of contact with Britain, and particularly the London area, that continued after independence, started to emulate sort of the up and current types of dialects that were happening in British speech. So it was particularly that around London, because London was really a cultural capital for much of the 1800s and early 1900s. And Americans still idolized sort of the former homeland. So there was a lot of emulation of London speech, particularly for Southerners who sent their children back a lot for education mm-hmm. in the late 1800s. And they picked up on current trends in London speech, one of which was the dropping of R. And so a lot of these young people that went back to study in London started using R dropping, started having their R's drop in certain places. And that's really how we get it throughout the South, New England, and in New York. It's really from this late addition to American speech by way of Britain. But the New York-New Orleans connection is quite fascinating because there actually have been a number of papers written by a linguist named Katie Carmichael about the fact that the New Orleans dropped R is probably related to the New York dropped R by large amounts of New York immigration into the New Orleans area quite a while ago, and that sort of helped spur this increased R dropping that was already prevalent among those that traveled back to Britain. So that's a long answer to a short question.
No, that's fascinating, man. You're teaching me some stuff. One thing I did want to address here, and sometimes we'll have some people on that are not trained broadcasters, and this does not reflect on you, Professor, at all, but, you know, they're very studied people, very learned people, but sometimes they'll say while they're talking, and people text in criticizing, and it's like, hello, could you maybe focus on the big picture here and not the delivery, but understand what they're saying about nuclear weapons or what they're saying about this or about that?
Right.
Filler words like that, can they actually be useful?
Actually, they are very useful, and like literally, dude, that is one of the top picks people had talked to me about. So I did include a chapter on them. And are fascinating because they're what we call in linguistics filled pauses, which are different than things like that a lot of people call filler words, but they are actually cognitively and structurally different than exists in all languages in the world. They may sound slightly different, but there's at least two in every language we have ever studied that serve the same purpose, which is that they seem to come up when we're pausing for a moment. They're a verbal way that we indicate to someone that we are thinking about what we're about to say. And they do seem to indicate that someone needs to do a little more cognitive planning, that that's what they're involved in. But how many people do you want to talk to that aren't thinking before they're speaking? So when we use what we're actually doing is we are using more cognitive resources. So they tend to happen when we're doing more complex things. So when I'm talking about topic I know well, in context I'm familiar, using words that are pretty small and familiar, I don't tend to When I do it, it's usually in context where I'm talking about more intellectual topics that take more cognitive processing, in contexts that are less colloquial, more formal, so I tend to be thinking more about the way I'm speaking, and that if they sort of indicate that I'm doing heavy thinking. So they are much more frequent when I'm doing harder work linguistically than when I'm doing easier work. And I don't know about you, but I actually want people to be thinking before they're talking to me. So
you would hope.
In that way, it's very good. But here's the really fascinating thing about and I could do a whole hour on these two particles. They're so amazing. But when we look at studies of how people hear when someone says something, they say an or a before it, and then we do tests on the listener about an hour after they heard that person talk. This is usually obviously in experimental settings. That person will actually remember the words that followed the more than they remember words that didn't.
Professor,
so it actually seems to assist.
We're out of time. We didn't get to and I want you to come back because this has been fascinating to me. I hope you come back. Will you please?
I'd be happy to.
Thank you. Valerie Friedland, professor of linguistics, author of Like Literally Dude, Arguing for the Good and Bad English. I can't wait to get the book and read it. We'll be back in a flash, find out what Newell's got for us today here on WWL.
Hey there, I'm Kendra Adachi, and my show, The Lazy Genius Podcast, helps you be a genius about the things that matter and lazy about the things that don't, and you get to decide what matters. I'm not here to tell you what to do. I'm here to give you a new way to see. Episodes of the Lazy Genius Podcast are full of compassionate time management tips and permission slips to do what makes sense for you. New episodes drop every Monday. Follow and listen to the Lazy Genius Podcast on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.